We're reading in Srimad Bhagavatam, the first canto, 15th chapter, the Pandavas retire timely. Text number 12, Arjuna is continuing to speak to Maharaj Yudhisthira. Translation. It was by his influence, again, his is Krishna, it was by his influence only that in a fight I was able to astonish the personality of God, Lord Shiva, and his wife, the daughter of Mount Himalaya. Thus he, Lord Shiva, became pleased with me and awarded me his own weapon. Other demigods also delivered their respective weapons to me, and in addition, I was able to reach the heavenly planets in this present body and was allowed a half-elevated seat. Srila Prabhupada's purport. By the grace of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna, all the demigods, including Lord Shiva, were pleased with Arjuna. The idea is that one who is favored by Lord Shiva or any other demigod may not necessarily be favored by the Supreme Lord, Sri Krishna. Ravana was certainly a great devotee of Lord Shiva, but he could not be saved from the wrath of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord Ramchandra. And there are many instances like that in the histories of the Puranas. But here is an instance where we can see that Lord Shiva became pleased even in the fight with Arjuna. The devotees of the Supreme Lord know how to respect the demigods, but the devotees of the demigods sometimes foolishly think that the Supreme Personality of Godhead is no greater than the demigods. By such a conception, one becomes an offender and ultimately meets with the same end as Ravana and others. The instances described by Arjuna during his friendly dealings with Lord Sri Krishna are instructive for all who may be convinced by the lessons that one can achieve all favors simply by pleasing the Supreme Lord Sri Krishna, whereas the devotees or worshippers of the demigods may achieve only partial benefits, which are also perishable, just as the demigods themselves are. Another significance of the present verse is that Arjuna, by the grace of Lord Sri Krishna, was able to reach the heavenly planet, even with the self-same body, and was honored by the heavenly demigod Indradev, being seated with him, half-elevated. One can reach the heavenly planets by the pious acts recommended in the Shastras in the category of fruitive activities, as stated in the Bhagavad Gita 9.21. When the reactions of such pious acts are spent, the enjoyer is again degraded to this earthly planet. The moon is also on the level with the heavenly planets, and only persons who have performed virtues only, performing sacrifices, giving charity, and undergoing severe austerities, can be allowed to enter into the heavenly planets after the duration of life of the body. Arjuna was allowed to enter into the heavenly planets in the self-same body simply by the grace of the Lord. Otherwise, it is not possible to do so. The present attempts to enter into the heavenly planets by the modern scientists will certainly prove futile, because such scientists are not on the level of Arjuna. They are ordinary human beings without any assets of sacrifice, charity, or austerities. The material body is influenced by the three modes of material nature, namely, goodness, passion, and ignorance. The present population is more or less influenced by the modes of passion and ignorance, and the symptoms for such influence are exhibited in their becoming very lusty and greedy. Such degraded fellows can hardly approach the higher planetary systems. Above the heavenly planets, there are many other planets also, which only those who are influenced by goodness can reach. And heavenly and other planets within the universe, the inhabitants are all highly intelligent, many more times than the human beings, and they are all pious in the higher and highest modes of goodness. They are all devotees of the Lord, and although their goodness is not unadulterated, still they are known as demigods, possessing the maximum amount of good qualities possible within the material world. So these are some of the adventures of Arjuna. Here you see the origin of many contemporary things. For example, video games, in which your guy has to go and endure various trials and then get special weapons. This is where this comes from. These stories of heroes like Arjuna, who is a special kind of person, actually. You know, he was conceived of Kunti Devi by, in fact, Indra. So he was half god, half human. We understand demigods. This one aspect of this verse is very interesting, of course, is here, by way of telling this story, Prabhupada outlines a whole picture of the universe which is not recognized in modern times. It's archaic, old-fashioned, medieval, or even earlier. We recognize stories like that in the West, in Norse mythology and Greek mythology. We call it mythology now. So what are we supposed to think about these things? We don't see demigods anymore. When's the last time they showed up? But you notice that that actually every culture, I think, almost every culture in the world, they have old stories like this. They have stories where some kind of beings from the higher planets came down, mingled with human beings, had sometimes had children with human women. We don't hear these stories, you know, we don't see them anymore. But everybody reports this. Everybody reports this. These kind of, what we call demigods. They have many human qualities, but still they're higher than we are. The gods we hear about in old Norse mythology and Greek, Roman, all these old stories. Of course, all these come, actually, these cultures actually come from Vedic culture originally. The German poet Schiller made one observation, 19th century German romantic poet. He said, in the days when the gods were more human, meaning these kinds of people, in the days when the gods were more human, humans were more divine. So actually, he put his finger on what happened, because this was what Prabhupada tells us, is there was a time before the advent of Kali Yuga, when in fact humans were more divine. And so therefore, because humans are more elevated, there was social relationships between the demigods and the humans, that Vedic culture is not just something that was on Earth, but is actually interplanetary culture, and that Earth was part of this larger galactic system of culture, and there was regular visits back and forth. It says that when Maharaj Prithu performed sacrifice, even ordinary people could see the demigods. They would show up. And you knew how to tell them. When you saw a demigod, there are three things you look for. Three characteristics of demigods. One, if you notice very carefully, their feet didn't quite touch the floor. They were like hovering a little bit off the floor. Their eyes didn't blink. For some reason, they had unblinking eyes. And their garlands did not wither. These are the symptoms that's reported for the demigods. So now we don't see them anymore, but it's only because conditions have become so degraded. As Prabhupada says, the present population is more or less influenced by the modes of passion and ignorance. So no demigods come here. We don't perform sacrifice anymore. Since the time of Lord Buddha, there hasn't been proper sacrifice of the Vedic sort. And the demigods do not visit. What happened to tourists in Sarajevo? You know, they don't come anymore. Maybe they tell stories of these legendary beings called tourists who used to come with their short pants and cameras and have a Deutschmarks right and left. You know, but where are they now? We don't see them anymore. So it's like that. Prabhupada is telling us a whole different version of history, because the current version of history says that civilization began at about the same time, actually. We date the beginning of Kali Yuga, the beginning of urban dwellings. One is the sign about 5,000 years ago, at least so far as archaeology has found out so far. And the appearance of writing. So writing is considered to be a great step forward for the advancement of the human race. You know, history means, first of all, only what survives, either what people save or what just happens not to be destroyed. That's the first filter, just by accident, what survives. And the other accident is what you happen to find. It's hard to make a statement. In fact, they keep making definite statements about the past, and then somebody digs another hole and finds something else, and an announcement announces, oh, everything we told you was wrong. Now it's like this. Then somebody, another excavation, another hole, and they find, no, it's not like that, it's like this. That's funny, like they never think to say, we actually don't know, and we will not know until we've dug all the holes. And even then, you know, the whole earth has been dug up, and even then, we're only dealing with what has survived. So we'll never know. It's actually inaccessible completely by this empirical speculation. But anyway, the idea is, as far as people can see, they date writing to about 5,000 years ago, which actually coincides with the time that Vyasadeva wrote down the Vedas. I suspect that there was writing before Vyasadeva wrote down the Vedas, but it was only used by shopkeepers and people like that to keep track of their inventory and stuff like that, you know. Because really intelligent people didn't need to write things down. They had good memories. And so that writing, according to our standard, is not the sign of an advancement of civilization, but is the sign of a decline. Because people's memories were good enough that they could... right now I have a computer with a hard drive, and that's my memory. Madhvacharya had all that in his head. Who's more advanced? I think I'm more advanced because he doesn't have, where's his computer, you know? If somebody can do a mathematical problem, solve a mathematical problem in his head, and the other person requires a calculator, who's more advanced? And then once you start using calculators, you lose all ability whatsoever. And in fact, you can see in Plato, the writings of Plato, he complained that because people are writing things down, they're losing their memories. He said it was very bad, actually, this habit of writing. Because, you know, even in the Greeks, the poetry of Homer, Iliad, the Odyssey, they were spoken. They were spoken. It was only written down later. So we just have got this conception of things. And it's all based on the idea that human beings appeared fairly recently, that they evolved upwards from the lower species of life. Then every human being was sort of in an aboriginal condition, and then gradually civilization emerged. And so that people think that now we're at the height of civilization. But Prabhupada is giving a completely different version of history. The modern conception is that the first appearance of life was some little squiggle of animated, strand of DNA, some molecule, that started to move by itself. Here, this idea, creation is from the top down. The first created being is Brahma, the highest, most elevated, and an intelligent, Adikavi, the first professor, doctor, Kaviraj. So this is what they would call an alternative history. What Prabhupada represents is a tradition that very self-consciously we find in the Bhagavatam this account that Vyasadeva saw that Kali Yuga was beginning, that people's memories would become short, they would become reduced in their intelligence. It's a fact. See, what we don't know is that actually all of us in Kali Yuga are suffering from brain damage. Organic brain damage. Because it's described in Kali Yuga that the potency of foodstuff has become reduced. And so the nourishment that we need to have good brains is gone. And so people are actually damaged. So we can't understand anymore what was easily understood or accessible by our forebears is now inaccessible to us. And so Vyasadeva sees this is going to happen, and so makes an arrangement to transmit into the darkness of Kali Yuga the inheritance from the past. Otherwise, it would be lost. And so, not just to write the Vedas down, but to put them in a form in which they could be understood by people even in these brain dead times, and to transmit them. So he taught them to various disciples so that there was a parampara, because tradition has to be alive. Tradition has to be alive. There has to be somebody that can represent it. You can have all the books in the world, but if there's nobody to teach you how to become qualified to understand the books, by hands-on demonstration, they'll be inaccessible. They won't understand them. You need teachers. Because it's not just theoretical, it's applied. Go to a piano. And try to teach yourself piano. So you can eventually play, Rachmaninoff and all that stuff. Try to do it just by yourself. And then try to do it with a qualified teacher. See what the difference is. One needs living tradition. So Vyasadeva made that arrangement. And so Prabhupada comes to the West and says, this is the tradition. He represents this attempt to preserve Vedic culture, keep it alive somehow or other during Kali Yuga. So when we see these books, see, when modern people see this book, they say, oh, this is primitive mythology. We can't understand Bhagavatam And so we think, oh, you know, what a vivid imagination. They think that all these stories like this, yeah, this is from a time, you know, it was like the cradle time of humanity. We were in our nursery and we had all these daydreams about demigods and things like that. But now we're grown up, you know, we don't need these things anymore. So many times you see this happen when somebody like Prabhupada is presenting something that's actually higher than we are. It's on a higher level than we are. And we think we're the highest already. We don't think there's anything higher. Then when we see it, we think, oh, these people are confused, bewildered. They don't know what they're talking about. That's why, like, even like some genius will come along with some new idea. And when people hear it the first time, what do they think? This is genius? No, they think he's crazy. They think he's on a lower level. Automatically, they make that judgment. They don't understand it, and they're because I don't understand it, therefore this person must be seriously deluded or crazy. I mean, sometimes they are, but the automatic response is, so therefore, there are many things that Prabhupada is, that is in this story, and you can see how Prabhupada believes it. This is the amazing thing about Prabhupada. He presented all these stories, and he never said, you know, we have to modify, change it in light of modern knowledge and so on like this, you know. He accepted it. We should accept it also. Now, it's true that we may not understand how it's true. Like this talk about this moon business, because Prabhupada put it in here, you know. The going to the moon. The present attempts to enter into the heavenly planets by the modern scientists will certainly prove futile, because such scientists are not on the level of Arjuna. Arjuna went up to Indraloka. Actually, Prabhupada wrote this, I think, before they went to the moon. I saw it on television myself. When it happened, before they went to the moon. But after they went to the moon, Prabhupada didn't believe it either. It didn't change his mind. They cannot go to the moon. A little later on, when Prabhupada brought out the fifth canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, which really different view of the universe than what we're accustomed to. Devotees had, you know, there were many people when that first came out. I mean, there were people that left the movement because of the fifth canto. I remember this. Prabhupada's, at that same time, he got a whole bunch of reporters together in Los Angeles. They didn't come to him. He had them come. And this is very typical of Srila Prabhupada. You should understand how he liked it, how he acted. And to these reporters, he announced that they didn't go to the moon. Why? Because the moon is farther than the sun. What was his argument? Sunday comes before Monday. It's Sunday, Monday. The sun's day, the moon's day, and so on. It was amazing that he did this. You know? And of course the reporters, they couldn't argue with him. Because it's true. Sunday comes before Monday. So what was Prabhupada doing? Well, I think one thing my understanding is the real problem is some devotees were having this crisis of faith. So just to show to everybody how convinced Prabhupada was, that he got in front of reporters who are the most cynical and skeptical people around, the professional non-believers, you know. They automatically assume that everybody they're talking to is lying. So he got the reporters around and then announced to them, of all people, that they didn't go to the moon. This is like the big achievement. The United States is so proud we went to the moon. He announced it didn't happen. And then he explained it on the basis that the moon is farther than the sun, therefore they couldn't have gone. Now, I have to say, one thing Prabhupada liked to do is, all I can say is, play with reporters. He liked to goof on them, you know. He liked to say something. He liked to provoke them. He really did. This was made some problems for the devotees sometimes here's an example. In Philadelphia, I happened to be sitting there. There was a woman who was doing a long feature article on us for the main newspaper in Philadelphia. And Prabhupada came in 1975, and he came to Rath Yatra. And so this reporter was not entirely favorable to Krishna consciousness. And her attitude was clear, I think. As she was challenging. And Prabhupada, whenever Prabhupada was challenged, he just went right back. the day after Rath Yatra, he was having a darshan, and this reporter was there. And she started to start out by saying, which came first? I forgot which came first, but the first thing she brought up is she said that everybody explains that you're a very renounced person and that you are very simple. Yet I noticed that when you came to the airport, and the devotees picked you up, they picked you up in a Cadillac limousine. Why is that? We really, in those days in America, limousines were kind of rare, and we really thought we were doing a big thing to hire this limousine to bring Prabhupada back. So he said to her, the spiritual master is worshipped on an equal level with God because he represents God. Sakshad haritoena samasta shastra. So actually, he says, Prabhupada said, God rides a golden car. His car is made of gold. So actually, my disciples should have given me a golden car. So actually, this Cadillac limousine is not enough. That's what he said. We were so proud of it. I was going, That's what he said. Yeah. He provoked them, you know. So then she says, somebody told me that in the parade yesterday, that in the air above the parade were invisible beings flying who were throwing down flowers, and that we couldn't see them, but you could. Of course, I was so upset. Who told this to the reporter? This is, he says, that the beings were there, and we couldn't see them, but you could. Is that true? And Prabhupada, his eyes got very big. He said, yes. And then Prabhupada said, you cannot see them because you are envious of the spiritual master. So this is the way Prabhupada would do with reporters a lot of times. I mean, you just have to understand this. You know, he would just like So this is what he said to these reporters in Los Angeles. They did not go to the moon. The moon is further than the sun. And the interesting thing is that which later on when the devotees questioned him, he, Prabhupada, knew very well that, in a sense, it's not true, even according to the fifth canto, that the moon is further than the sun. The fifth canto shows Bhumandala, and the planets are above Bhumandala. Now, you can say the earth is over here, if it's Bharatvarsha, and Jambudvip, and then Bhumandala goes way out here. And then above, then the sun is here, close to the plane of Bhumandala. The moon is here, higher up. So if you measure up straight from Bhumandala, the moon is further than the sun. If you measure from Earth, the moon is closer by the straight line, just from Jambudvip going up. So it depends on what you mean. Whether you, by Earth, you mean, you know, Bharatvarsha, or whether you mean, Prabhupada knew this. So what was he doing? He just was wanting them to know that they didn't go to the moon. That he knew. Whatever reason, you know, is another thing. Because then he gave various theories, actually. The three different ways that they didn't go to the moon, Prabhupada gave. One was that the whole thing was fake. He remarked that at one point he had seen a movie in which a giant monkey was on the top of a skyscraper. That's King Kong, of course, the original of 1932. He said he'd seen that, so he knew things are possible by special effects. So that was one possibility, that the whole thing was a hoax. And by the way, there's a lot of people that believe that. It's not that view doesn't have followings. Independently of ISKCON, I mean, there's an old engineer from NASA who National Aeronautics and Space Administration, who claims that the whole thing was a hoax. Yeah. Well, whatever it's worth, I don't know. The second place he suggests in Bhagavatam, that maybe they went to Rahu or Ketu, because those planets are actually would look like the moon. See, we know what the moon looks like. It's described. What they show or depict or describe isn't what the moon looks like. It's not a barren desert. And in fact, Prabhupada thought, one of the clues that Prabhupada thought was that it was a hoax was what they kept comparing the moon to, or when they had, went to Mars, landed to the Arizona desert. And he said, see, this is where. And then the other one, the third hypothesis, which is the one that does sort of least damage to your conventional ideas, is that, well, they may have gone there, but they could not enter into the atmosphere. In other words, they remained in spaceships and in the Earth atmosphere. So that would be somebody comes illegally to the United States, like these boat people at one time in Cuba. They were, you know, floating across the waters to get to Florida. So they're grabbed at the shore, or people are coming. Entered the, in one sense, they were in America, but it wasn't like what they were thinking. It was just some camp with a bunch of tents and open latrines and a big pot of khichdi or something. Rice and beans, you know, and then back you go. So they didn't really come to America. They never got their passport stamped. They never got a visa. They never came in. So anyway, so Prabhupada gave different explanations, so. But the point was, he wanted to say they didn't go, because here we have the description. So anyway, how you understand these accounts, that may be different. For my part, I accept that they're true. I may not understand how they're true, how you reconcile it with our visible experience. That's another thing. But that they're true, that I don't doubt. We just may not be qualified to understand what's exactly going on. Sataputta has done some work on this. If you're interested in the fifth canto, he has a book called Mysteries of the Sacred Universe with a CD-ROM also. You can study these things. So here we have Arjuna, because he's a great hero and a warrior, he fights with Lord Shiva. And his wife was present, the daughter of the mountain king, Girija, that's what it means, born of the mountains, daughter of the mountain king, Parvati. He gets from him special weapon. And similarly, the other demigods, they all give him special weapons. You know, people would say magical weapons, but they just have powers that Prabhupada said magic means, or no, miracle. Prabhupada said miracle means you don't know how it's done. That's all. Huh? You don't know how it's done. It's not exactly something transcendental. It's just there are higher levels of technology, and people don't understand them, and they because we don't have that technology. Otherwise, people even. Oh, I remember once we went to one of my first trips to India. At that time, there came out in America a product which I think didn't remain, but somebody had some shaving cream, and you squirted it out in your hand. It foamed up. And then it got hot. You know, inside there were two chemicals that were separate, and when they came out, they mixed together, and then the mixture of those chemicals produced heat. You know, it's just a simple chemical reaction. But it was an amazing thing. You put the shaving cream in your hand, and then it gets hot. So somebody thought, well, that'll be nice for India, because that time we were shaving at pumps, you know, and the water was really cold, so you had some hot shaving cream, you know, it was nice. Make it easier to shave. So we're all standing around this pump, and this guy is showing everybody. We go, wow, that's interesting, you know, this hot shaving cream, you know. And then this local washerman comes by, you know, this local village guy, and he sort of comes over and wants to see what's going on. So none of us spoke Bengali, but we just said, hold your hand out. And he held his hand out, and the guy squirted this foaming shaving cream in his hand. And he watched it, and it got hot. And he looked at the guy, and he said, Bhagavan! Bhagavan! It was a miracle. So many amazing things are there. So here Arjuna gets these various weapons. And clearly we like these stories. Otherwise, why are they, you know, these same kind of stories, they survive in science fiction and video games and stuff like that. But here's the real story. And I don't know, we should notice that here, who the demigods are, what they are cosmocrats. This is a word that's in the Bible, actually, St. Paul. Cosmocrats, a bureaucrat. But a cosmic bureaucrat, so a cosmocrat, the administrators of the universe. We see that it's the same system. Prabhupada gives the example that in the city, you know, there's water coming, and there's lights, electricity, and there's departments that provide these facilities, and these departments have people. Ultimately, who are in charge. It may be quite automatic. There's pipes. They deliver these things. But ultimately, for electricity, for water, for heat, for gas, there are people behind the system. So actually, the whole universe is working on this principle. Because God is a person, that there are people on every level down below. Again, the modern world does not accept these people. This is a product of modern thinking. It happened in the Enlightenment,
Aufklärung, you know, the European Enlightenment, and a process the German sociologist Max Weber, he calls it disenchantment. The disenchantment of the world, Entzauberung, the disenchantment of the world. And the other word he uses is de-divinization. The gods disappear. Because now we're thinking that we want to control the universe ourselves. We have this knowledge by applying mathematics to the universe. We think we can control it. And it seems irrational to us that if there are other people up there controlling it, it's going to make it hard for us to do so. No, no, somehow or other the universe is like a machine. You see, people became obsessed with this metaphor that the universe is a machine. Because Isaac Newton had discovered certain laws, that there's certain regular behavior and you can describe it according to mathematics. This then became the key to all and everything. And if I can understand something of the universe by mathematics, then the speculation is that the universe can be understood completely by mathematics. And therefore, it must be like a clock. You know, in the 18th century, you should have seen the clocks, you know, the big clockwork that people have. Where all the parts are working together, completely deterministic machine, and you can describe it completely in terms of numbers. So the universe is therefore a clock. Our bodies were clocks. We were basically automaton robots. What about the soul? Well, the soul is a kind of ghost in the machine. You know, haunting in there, but really there's no place, you know. This completely mechanistic view of the human being, of the universe, of everything. All because people were captivated by a little success in mathematics and in this speculation. So that's where the gods went. They have no place in this universe. There's a clock. Even God who created it, they had the idea that maybe there was a God who made this big cosmic clock. But once he made it and wound it up, he backed off. He may be there somewhere, but he's not involved anywhere in the running of things. This is the world. Of course, even in physics, everybody discovered it was wrong. In fact, they knew it was wrong. If the people, really, from the beginning. Because Newton had put out these ideas. And then another guy who also invented the calculus, Leibniz, had some arguments against Newton that actually could not be answered. They were not answered until Einstein. Now Einstein reigns supreme, but believe me, it's also wrong. Because it's speculation. How much have you seen? When Prabhupada was arguing with the devotees, he liked to take the point of a modern scientist, you know, and would defend Krishna consciousness, the devotees would take the role of a scientist, present Prabhupada with these scientific ideas, and Prabhupada would defend Krishna consciousness. Sometimes Prabhupada would reverse the roles. Once he pretended to be a Mayavadi and nobody could defeat him. Everybody was really upset. But anyway, so he liked to do both sides, you know. I mean, he's just like debate a lot. So anyway, this one morning walk, the devotees were taking the position of a modern scientist. So one of the devotees objected to Prabhupada by saying, "We haven't seen it." And Prabhupada said, "What have you seen?" He said, "The inside of your mother's womb." You know, you have very little experience. And this is true. And you'll begin to notice, every day I read the newspaper, in America, the New York Times actually, it's the only newspaper in America that actually knows there's a world outside the United States practically. So I find out what's going on in India and Europe and all these things. Otherwise, if you read the, every papers are relentlessly local. Anyway, and the Times is very good at reporting what's happening in science. You know. In fact, every Tuesday they have one section on just science. You know. And almost every week they tell you that everything they had been telling you is wrong. Because just recently some skull was found in Africa and they have to completely revise their idea of human evolution. And now, you know, actually they're a little in doubt as to what the case is, but, you know, they'll come up with a new theory. Then I guarantee you somebody will find another skull and again will be told, you know, that everything we told you was wrong. Now somehow or other, people don't mind this. They don't mind. You know, when I was in school, I was told that dinosaurs were these sluggish, cold-blooded animals that, you know, walked very slow and, you know, they had to warm up before they could move. Now, you know, they're fast and they jump around, you know, like in these Jurassic Park things, you know. They have all kinds of colors and fur and all this other kind of stuff, you know. Completely different from what I was told. And nobody has apologized to lying to me. Nobody has ever said, I'm sorry, everything we taught you with authority as the truth was wrong. We're so sorry. Because if they have to do that, then I'll think, well, what about what you're telling me now? Because they don't say what you're telling me now is wrong. What they say is, when they change things, is they say, this is the words they use, we used to think such and such, but now we know such and such. That's cheating. What they should say is, we used to know, but now we think. So if you look at the actual enterprise, the latest finding in astronomy is the confirmed, I don't know how they confirmed it, presence of what they call dark matter and dark energy. Dark means you can't detect, very hard to detect. We would say subtle, I guess. But they mean it's very difficult to detect. But subtly you can detect it. It turns out that Einstein came to predict such a thing because of mathematics, mathematical physics, but then thought it was so weird he rejected the idea. But now, some subtle observations shows that actually there's dark matter, there's some matter about which we can't, so far, can know very little, and also dark energy. And it's most of what there is. It's most of what there is. That's the latest thing. So I should tell you that from all of this, from what Prabhupada has said, and then from looking, when I started to be alert to what was going on, to how fast everything changes, simply because people, they look a little more, they get a more powerful telescope, they dig another few holes, they travel to some place nobody's traveled before, they just notice something that they never noticed. It's all been in front of your eyes, but you never noticed it. You never knew it was important. You never knew it was interesting. Suddenly, all of a sudden, for some reason, you look for it. Because knowledge is theory-driven. What you look for, what you find, often depends on what you're looking for to begin with. And something that's just in the way and you throw aside may be the biggest clue in the world to something else, but you never noticed. This is the way it works. So my conviction is that what we know, that is to say by empirical investigation, is less than 1/100, 1/1000th of 1% of what there is to be known, and most of that is wrong. So I feel completely confident, not believing in practically anything modern scientists say, that they've seen something, you know, that I'll accept. I can, but how they understand it, what they make of it, how they fit it into the bigger framework, all the speculation, not a bit, not a bit. I'm not particularly bothered by the description. I really accept that this is coming down, the true accounts of a higher culture, and we barbarians are just beginning to learn how to understand it. That's what I think. And I have to say one more thing. That when I first joined the Krishna consciousness movement, you know, I was in a graduate school in religious studies. And I wrote a letter to Srila Prabhupada. Do you have any suggestion of what I should try to do in my academic work? And he made a suggestion. His suggestion was that it would be good if I could disprove Darwin. And this really freaked me out. The reason it freaked me out is that I never really thought my way through all the implications of what Prabhupada said. It didn't really gel, you know, come complete to me how serious Prabhupada was about how creation took place. I was still ready to maybe accept things that are, you know, symbolic or something like that. But actually, because, you know, even sophisticated Christians that are still practicing Christians, if they have any education at all, they somehow believe that God is working through the process of evolution, but not that evolution is wrong. The people that believe that evolution is wrong, though all the ones I ever met were great, big, stupid, neon Jesus Save signs. They didn't know anything, but they knew that Jesus saved. I grew up among these people. You know, the fundamentalist right-wing Christians in America. And I really didn't like them. And now when Prabhupada said, defeat Darwin, that's who I thought of, you know, these people. These backwards, uneducated, often very low class people. And the other thing was, I had no idea of how to defeat Darwin. I had yet to hear any respectable intellectual argument that Darwin was wrong. Every intelligent person I knew accepted that it was right. And the only argument against it I ever heard is that the Bible says it's wrong. And I didn't have that much faith in the Bible because I didn't have that much faith in the people who represented the Bible. So what to do? And then I read this letter over by Srila Prabhupada so many times, and I thought, well, how could I ever do this, to show that Darwin is wrong to intelligent people? And then it wasn't too much later that I met this devotee, Sariputta. At that time, he had just finished his PhD in mathematics. I think at that time he was he was on traveling Sankirtan with New Vrindavan or something. He didn't know what to do with a PhD in mathematics in New Vrindavan. Finally, they made him the treasurer. You know, people had no idea what to do with this guy. He thought he was weird, and he had all this stuff in his head. He'd best get rid of it and chant Hare Krishna, you know. So the fundamentalists, you know. So anyway, he came to my temple, and so I started talking to him about this stuff because he was a mathematician. And it turns out he was convinced, on scientific reasons, that Darwin was wrong. And he had come to this conclusion before he'd become a devotee. Because his area of specialty was this thing called information theory. And when you used information theory to use mathematics to examine evolution, you could see that it didn't work. So he knew that evolution was mathematically or logically impossible. And that he thought biologists were all idiots. He was a mathematician. They're on a higher plane, you know, of course. And the unfortunate thing is that biologists, being low-class scientists, don't really understand mathematics enough. So we sat down and we discussed these arguments, and then we talked about the fossil record, and he had some ideas how that was wrong, but clearly he had several arguments using information theory and analyzing certain things about how it's impossible. Things that really bothered Darwin, how an eye could evolve. Darwin also saw these problems, actually. But they sort of got swept under the rug and everybody went on going. So it was interesting because first I just said, okay, Prabhupada says that Darwin is wrong. Evolution didn't happen. I'll accept it because he says so, but I had no idea how it was wrong. But then, you know, I met this devotee, Sariputta. We began to talk about it. And then a little later on, Prabhupada made this Bhaktivedanta Institute. I was one of the people, there was five of us that were the founding people. I was one of them. So I began to work more and more with this idea. And so things have developed now. And just before I came here, I saw there was an article on the very front page of the New York Times. In America, there's still the fundamentalists that I grew up with in Texas and Oklahoma. They've become more politically powerful over the last 25 years or so. And so in many cases, they've been, there's a group of them that have actually made many years ago, they have organizations again, try to get, what they call, creationism accepted in the schools. They call it scientific creationism. The one problem is because they're Christians, they have to try to fit everything in creation into about a 5,000-year framework, because by biblical genealogy they decide that the universe is very young. Everything was created, you know, 5,000-6,000 years ago, because they wanted to fit it with the Bible. And so these people have been trying to do this Creation Research Institute. In fact, when we started the BI, we wrote to them and said, you know, we may have some differences, but at least we have in common that evolution is wrong, and we have many arguments that you haven't thought of, you know, could we work together, make a common cause with these people? And they wrote back, this guy, Gish, who was their leader, and he declined. And he said that they can't work with us because we're of the devil. And that we have to accept Jesus Christ in our hearts as our personal Savior before, you know, they could consider working with us. So that was that. So recently in America, there was a big thing because a couple of states like Kansas... Anyway, there was a whole political effort of the right-wing Christians to take over state boards of education. You know, they tried to have a candidate for president, this Pat Robinson, and it didn't work. And, you know, they would only get so far. The majority of Americans are very uncomfortable by these people, but they work hard and they're very determined. And so they changed their strategy, and which is to try to take over on the very local level. So you get these little local government committees, and you get one of these Christians on there, but they work very hard. They'll do all the work. They'll write the minutes. They'll become the chairman. You know, nobody else wants to do this stuff. They do all the work, and then gradually it comes out who they are. So they in several states they took over these state boards of education. And then when they took over, they started to say that the textbooks that the schools use in our state, because this is done not by the on a national basis, but on a state-by-state basis, have to teach alternative theories. You teach Darwin, but then you teach the scientific creationism. And so they became successful in the state of Kansas. And there was a big thing. There was election for the State Board of Education. Once everybody woke up to what was happening, they voted them back down again. But it was in all the newspapers. So that's why in the front page of the New York Times it said that now there's a different theory, a different argument against evolution, a design theory that now has achieved respectability among intellectuals. And this is different from this fundamentalist creationism. And it's the same thing Sariputta was telling me about 25 years ago. Because those arguments have gradually been picking up. Various professors who are departments of biology are now using them. And the New York Times has said that now there are academic conferences about it, and now it's becoming the whole thing is on a different level, this idea. And then they gave some of the arguments. Unfortunately, I don't think Sariputta or anybody in ISKCON got any credit for it, although we were the first ones to really propagate these ideas. That's because people still don't want to be they don't want to be associated with the Christian fundamentalists. Hare Krishna is also a little, declassé, actually this is where these ideas have gotten into the air and been propagated. And so it's funny to see, I just never would have dreamed, when I got that letter from Prabhupada, Defeat Darwin, that 30 years later, I would see on the front page of the New York Times, these arguments. Now said, it's a new world because now they're being taken seriously by academicians. I mean, the people who are against them say, yeah, they cloak their ideas, it looks like it's real science, but actually, it's more subtle and stuff like that, but they're wrong. But now it's a fact that they are, these sorts of same kind of arguments that Sariputta was making are now respectable. So stick to your guns, What now is a very, very unpopular and nobody will believe it. I could very well believe, 10 years from now, the hoax revealed, moon. I don't know. I mean, it's always possible. I'm still not sure how they did go to the moon, but you could see it.